So remember that what we have shown is that basically the propagator that I was calling, for instance, K of Q2, Q1, T, which represent the probability amplitudes of going from point Q1 at time 0 to point Q2 at time T, it can be represented as a path integral over passes of exponential I over h bar times the action of this for this particle with the, of course, the initial condition that Q of 0 equal Q1 and Q of T equal Q2. Okay? And we have seen that similarly, we have an Euclidean formalism. So this is in real time here. This is, we have real time. And we had an Euclidean for, we can study also what's happening in Euclidean time. And then the analogous of that is that you are computing exponential minus 1 over h bar, a sum of a passes with an Euclidean action. And so that's the ordinary action. So this is a phase. And this is the Euclidean action, which is positive. So this is some kind of probability factor, which weights path. Okay? And I remember that the action for the particle so is simply the sum of the kinetic energy minus the potential, while the Euclidean action is the integral from 0 to some Euclidean time tau of d sigma m over 2 q dot squared plus v of q. Okay? Okay. So now, of course, one interesting question is what's happening if you consider that h bar is small. Of course, we know that the Planck's constant is a constant. It's a constant of nature. You can measure it, but you cannot change it. But of course, you can in some, when you are considering some physical system, you can, it's a unit of action, in fact. So it's a unit of action. So you can compare whether the typical action of the trajectories you are considering in your system is large or small compared to h bar. Yes? You see? You know, h bar is a quantum, or h, in fact, is a quantum of action. So it means that, if, for instance, when you study the quantization of the hydrogen atom to each orbit, the orbit of the electron around the atom during one orbit, it makes a trajectory, some circular or elliptic orbit in the semi-classical picture, in the Bohr picture. And to this orbit, you associate an action. And if this action is small, it means that quantum effects are important. If this action is large, it means that quantum effects are small, not important. And for the ground state and the lower level of the hydrogen atom, quantum effects are important. But if you go to very high level, what they call Rydberg space, you can describe them quite accurately with just Bohr orbits and classical orbits. Okay, so H means that you're in a quantum regime, and H bar small means that you are a semi-classical regime in some sense. And when H bar is large, you are in a quantum regime where the quantum effect will be important. You cannot neglect them. Okay? So, of course, now this is. Now, the question is, when you are considering this path integral, are there some trajectories more important than some others in this small semi-classical regime? And as you know, the answer is yes, because in fact, this is just a generalization of simple Gaussian integrals. So for instance, there are the Gaussian integral, I think, that you have studied in the tutorial, or that you will be studied. With, in that case, this is a more complicated case of an integral, which is integral over dq of exponential of I over h bar, let us say, q2 over 2. This is just a single variables. It's not a path, so it's a single variable, so it's a zero dimensional, if you want, integral. You integrate just one variable, and this is, you have the similar here, integral from d cube exponential minus 1 over h bar q squared over 2. From minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay. And you know that for an integral like that, the integrand for this function as a function of q is just, let us use some color, it's just a Gaussian. Okay, with a width which is of order square root of h bar. You see? So what's important, what's dominate here is the maximum. This is the maximum of this function. And what's important is what's happening in the integral around this formula. Okay? Here it's the same thing, except that you have a phase. So here as a function of q. Now I can, of course, this is a phase. So this is a unit function, but what I can draw is the real part and the imaginary part. So let us see what is the real part of this function. At u equals 0, it's 1. And then it's a function which, of course, starts like that. But then it starts to oscillate very widely because the phase varies very quickly here. And for the imaginary part, that's the same thing except that it's a sine of q squared. So it's a function which starts like that, let's say, and which also starts to. Okay, so the green is the real part, and the orange is the imaginary part. Okay, and you see that in that kind of integral, in fact, you have a compensation, you have oscillation, if you want, which are very, very quick. And as soon as you integrate, you are interested in computing the average of some smooth function with this phase factor, only this this term, this region counts. And this region is also of order square root of h bar. Okay? So, and what is this point? This point is, of course, not the maximal of this function, but it's a point here, this point, which dominate, is a point where the phase is stationary. Because the phase is q squared over 2. So here you look at the maximum, namely the minimum of q squared, of the function q squared. And here you see also, you look also at the point where q squared is stationary. Okay. And in both cases, you can estimate such a function simply by looking at the dominant contribution, which is a contribution of the point in the integral where the phase is stationary in the imaginary Gaussian integral, and to the point where the factor here, the action, is minimal in the case of a Gaussian real integral. And that's also called the saddle point. Saddle point, because you see, you can view this as two valleys, and you have a saddle point here. And you have to pass through the saddle in order to make the integration. So hence the name of saddle point approximation to estimate such integral here, and the name of stationary phase approximation to estimate such integral. So now, what does it give when you what does it give when you want to estimate the a real path integral? It is simply that in the real-time time, you have to estimate the point where, which is a classical configuration such that delta S over delta Q is equal to zero. And of course, this gives the classical trajectory, which has solution of, in our case, M Q dot equal minus V prime of Q. Okay, while in this case, we have to minimize the action. So we have an Euclidean classical trajectory, which is the minima of the variation of the Euclidean action. And so these are Euclidean, if you want, Euclidean trajectories, which are solution of almost the same equation. Okay. That it's plus V prime of Q. Okay. So this is the equation for the classical trajectory. And then you have to estimate what is the contribution then. So this means that this functional, this path integral, for instance, is dominated by the value of the action for the classical trajectory. So that's a good first approximation for the propagator, the probability amplitude to propagate from Q1 to Q2. And then you have the fluctuation. And then you can use a Gaussian approximation. And basically, you get a factor which will be something that you can write a bit formally, like the determinant of I over h bar. There is a 2 pi factor which comes from the normalization. And you have the determinant of some operator where this, so this is a k, is, you can approximate like that, where this is an operator which is basically the derivative of the action, the classical action, when you make two derivatives . So it's the curvature, the local curvature of the action around the classical action. So I won't describe what it is more, but I think you have already started to compute such determinant of operators, and you will do that later on in the tutorials. You have a factor that you can compute, which is basically the determinant of some operator in front of that. Okay? And here you have exactly the same analogy. You have that the Euclidean amplitude, if you want, or propagator is, it's the same thing. First, you have a minus 1 over h bar, the Euclidean action for the Euclidean trajectory. And then you have a factor, which is here now a determinant of, you have no I because it's a real Gaussian integral. And you have a 1 over h bar, 2 pi, times the operator, which is the second derivative of the Euclidean action as with the same minus 1/2 factor, okay? Okay. So this is the contribution of the classical trajectory. And this is the contribution of the non-classical, but close to classical. Trajectories. The analog in the space of all the trajectories of this region or of this region in the integral. Yes?
Yeah. So the square root should be of the determinant or?
I'm sorry. The square root, yes, you are right. The square root is you compute a determinant and you get a factor minus 1/2 like here. So you have a big determinant, but once you have taken this determinant, you take minus the 1 over its square root. That's just the generalization to infinite dimensional operator of a formula on Gaussian integration that you have studied in the first week. Okay. So now the question, one interesting question is what do they look like? The classical trajectory is smooth, but the non-classical trajectory may be non-smooth. And I just want to show you a picture of what's going on, if I found my picture back, which is that. Where is it? I think I have it. Okay, I don't have picture at that time, but basically, in fact, you can show that, for instance, consider, I will show the picture here. Consider what's going on when you have, so this is Q, this is time. I consider a free particle, so I consider that V equals zero, so that I have a free particle. Then the classical trajectory are just trajectory of let me use Z for a classical trajectory. It's just a constant speed trajectory. So this is a classical trajectory or history of your systems. But then you have a lot of fluctuating trajectories which comes around here like that. Okay, like that. Okay, so this is one of the classical trajectory. Here is a second one, okay, etc. And you have a whole bunch of classical trajectory. And you may ask, what are the non-classical or semi? What are the semi-classical, if you want, classical trajectories, whose contribution sums up to give this this factor. And in fact, it is easy to show that those semi-classical trajectories are nothing but Brownian motions, or random walks, if you want, at least locally. So, the typical trajectory is a trajectory which is a random trajectory which satisfies some equation, which is typically that the derivative with respect to time, so the speed, is not fixed like a classical trajectory, but it is, of course, it will be the Q classical of t, which is fixed, but then you have a random variable, eta of t, which is a random variable. And there will be of order h bar to the power minus plus 1/2. So that when h bar is small, the fluctuations are small. And when h bar is large, the fluctuations are large. And this is a random variable, in fact. And it's, in fact, what is called the white noise, because it satisfies a correlation function that eta of t prime, on the average, is delta of t minus t prime. So it's a very simple random process, which is only condition to start from the point Q1 and to end up at the point Q2. Yes?
An equation, should it be Q plus equal dot?
Pardon? Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, the speed is the classical speeds plus a random noise with simply the condition that you must end up at it. So this means that, in fact, those semi-classical trajectories are already quite singular object. Because, for instance, if you are interested in what is the average, what is the typical instant speed, the instant speed of the trajectories. Since there is a delta function, it means that the delta of t squared is infinite, if one, because it's delta of zero, the Dirac distribution, which means that as an instant instantaneous speed is infinite in a mathematically well-defined speed. So you cannot talk about the instantaneous speed of a quantum particle in this picture. Okay. And, but that's something not surprising, because that's nothing but the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which means that if you know exactly where the particle is, you cannot say what is speed or is momentum. So this is just a mathematical way to reformulate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in the language of path integral. So everything is consistent. Okay? So now I will end up this discussion about semi-classical limit by discussing a little bit what's happening when you have multiple trajectories and interference. Before that, I would say that, of course, this is exactly the same in real and Euclidean time. The semi-classical, the classical Euclidean trajectory doesn't obey to the same equation, except when v equals zero, but the fluctuation, you see the typical typical configuration we contribute to the path integral are in the same domain for an imaginary Gaussian integral and for a real Gaussian integral. So it's basically the same kind of trajectory which contributes with different weight in real-time path integral and in Euclidean path integral. So you can keep this image in mind for both formalism. Okay? And finally, I want to discuss a little bit what's happening when you have quantum interference. Okay, because for instance, the typical case where you have quantum interference is when you have a double slit experiment, two slit experiment. I think we have discussed that already in the quantum theory course. So you have a problem where you have a particle which starts at some point. So you can view, in fact, if this particle are emitted with a constant speed, you can say, okay, as a function of time, now as a function of time, I have a particle which starts at point zero. Okay, but simply at some point during the evolution, at time t, your particle will reach a screen here and there are detectors. But at some point in between, there is a screen so that which is reached by the particle at time t1. And so that, in fact, the allowed trajectory for the particle are of two kinds. The trajectory, the quantum trajectory, can go through one slit or through another slit. So in fact, in that case, the probability amplitude will be given by a sum of, you will first have a term which will be the sum of contribution of trajectory going through the first slit. So the probability amplitude will be a sum of exponential minus I over h bar s for q1 times this determinant factor, let me call it delta 1 plus delta 2 exponential I over h bar s over q2. So q1 is this trajectory. Q2 is this trajectory going through slit 1 and slit 2. And this is contribution. Delta 1 and delta 2 are the contribution of the quantum trajectory, which are near. So this is the contribution of delta 1. And this is the contribution of delta 2. Okay, and you have to sum the contribution of both semi-classical trajectory in order to get the correct amplitude. And it is well known that if you use this formula, you get, of course, the famous quantum interferences, which implies, for instance, that you get, in fact, here, quantum interferences in the amplitude and the probability, so the probability amplitude and in the probability to detect a particle along the screen. So, in fact, this, the path integral formalism with this semi-classical picture, in fact, takes into account the fact that you have quantum interference even in a semi-classical regime where you can speak of a trajectory of a single particle, but you have to sum over trajectories. Okay, so it's a simple exercise that you, for example, you recover the classical formula for the double slit experiment using semi-classical form picture like that. Okay? And this works for the two-slit experiment, but this works very well also for much more complicated systems where you have a lot of classical trajectories. And I want just to mention one last thing, which is that... Well, I hope I won't have broken everything by the end of the course. Yes?
So for the two double slit experiment,
yes?
What is the action? Is it free particle action?
Well, then you take the action you want. You know, if you have free particles, you take just the action of a free particle, except that, of course, you have some potential along the slit, which force the particles to go just through the slits. But it depends on the problem. If you make an interferometry experiment of neutrons, which you are guiding through some magnetic field, and which the trajectory is deformed through the interaction of the spin of the neutron with the magnetic field, and there are nice experiments of neutron interferometry to detect the influence of the gravitational fields on the quantum interference doing that way, then you have to use take into account the gravitational field, so you have an external potential, and you have to take into account also the effect of the interaction of the spin with it. So the action will be more complicated. But in general, you have the action for the given problem, and then you have to compute the general. So it's a kind of very general formula. Okay. So I wanted just to mention that, for instance, you have something, a very beautiful formula, which is called the trace formula for the energy, for the density of states, of state of a quantum system. So I won't explain at all what it means, but it says the trace formula, in fact, are due to Gutzwiller in the 31, I think. And there are also similar formula which are derived by Ballion and Bloch, two French physicists around the same time. And basically the idea, if when you look at, you have a classical system given by some action, and you are interested in computing the density of state as a function of energy. And for instance, these systems may be, you know, you may have a box, and you have a particle in a box, and a classical trajectory can be very, very complicated, you see, if the system is like that. Okay? But there is a beautiful formula which tells us that the density of states, of course, in the h-bar goes to zero limit, so in the semi-classical limit, you know that the formula, there will be just a classical formula obtained by a classical method. You count, you know, for instance, you know that you do classical physics and you count the number of points, the volume of the phase space of your system, and it gives the density of state, or if you want, the Liouville measure of the system. So it's purely classical. But when you want to take into account the quantum effect, in fact, there is a beautiful formula which tells you that when h bar equal to zero, you can take into account the quantum formulation by summing over all the periodic orbits of energy E. Okay? So for instance, in a BR like that, you have many, many classical orbits. And some have energy E, some have other energy. So you have to take into account all the classical orbits, whatever the period here. The period may be very, very large, but of energy E. And then you have a contribution which is exactly of the same time, except that we are computing a density, so you have to take the real part of some amplitudes. And there is some delta factor for each periodic orbit, which depends on the energy. You have to compute that. And then you have a phase factor, which is exactly of the same kind. It is the action of the orbit plus the period T of the orbit times the energy. So this is a modification because we are working in fixed energy instead of working in fixed time. So this is the period of the orbit. Okay, and this is basically a factor, which is basically the contribution of the fluctuations around the orbits. And this kind of semi-classical formula works very well for for systems which have a very, very complicated classical dynamics. So you can use, in fact, this path integral formulation and this semi-classical picture for systems which are classically quite complicated and which, so there is a lot of quantum interference even when you try to build the density of state and study the spectrum, the density. And perhaps I can just show a picture, which is an old picture taken from the paper of Balion and Bloch and reproduced in a book by Parisi. So it's a very classical result, but may I have the screen, please? I know what I have to do. No, it's okay. Yes. There's some countdown going on. I hope it won't blow up. Yes. Okay. So what you see here is, in fact, I won't explain in detail, but this is basically the density of state of some system. It's a particle inside a sphere, but it's a three-dimensional sphere, so the spectrum is not completely trivial, and the density of state is non-trivial. And this curve here, this straight curve, is just the density of state, the classical density of states for a particle in the sphere, and it's a well-known exercise that shows that it's linear, it grows linearly with the energy, okay? And these are a curve, so you have two curves which are very, very close. I don't remember which one. I think the fine line is the exact density of state obtained when you quantize, solve the Schrodinger equation. And the the fat line is density of state obtained by such kind of trace formula. And you see that, in fact, even in a simple system like a particle in a sphere, the density of state of a quantum system has some complicated oscillation. Of course, you have basically peaks which correspond to the eigenmodes of the sphere. But then you have some subtle quantum interference effects. And those quantum interference effects are already taken into account by such kind of trace formula. So you see, there is the path integral formulation and the semi-classical picture you get out of it is something which goes already quite deep when you try to understand what are quantum effects and quantum interference. Yes?
So The chase formula, is that a semi-classical approximation?
Yeah, it's a semi-classical approximation because you neglect, in fact, there. This is basically you have a term which is of order h bar to the power some power, and then you receive an exponential of I over h bar. But the general theory tells you that then you have subdominant contribution like power, infinite series of h bar, and you may have other contribution coming from other kind of non-perturbative contribution. So in fact, this is not at all a mathematically rigorous theory. And mathematicians have been working on such kind of trace formula for a long time. And in some cases, they can prove that it's valid in some regime. In some cases, it just drives them mad. But it works very well.
So the thin line was computed using numerical methods?
I don't remember. I have to look at the value. And I think, yeah. It's an old paper, so they didn't have all the computer power available at that time. But it's an exact result in some sense. Yes?
So here, like the classical contribution is what? On the
The classical contribution is just the straight line. You see? So this is a classical density of state. The volume of phase space at fixed energy. And you see that in order to get the real spectrum, you must add to this classical, which is on the average is very good. You know, if you make an average on some finite fixed energy range, you smooth out all those peaks and those oscillations, and you get, on the average, the classical picture. But if you want to get all the semi-classical oscillation, you must take into account the contribution of periodic orbits. Yes?
And why is the quantum exact density of states continuous variable, and we don't get discontinuous jumps whenever we get to the exponential level?
I think it's because it's smoothed in some way. So there are a lot of technical details that I'm not. I think you smooth a little bit, you average a little bit the density of state, and you are checking the formula in this case. So in some sense, you are smoothing over the density of states over an energy interval which is smaller than what you should be doing when doing the real classical limit, but larger than what you want to do if you want really to study the eigenvalues, the eigenset, one by one. So you study a packet, a bunch of eigenstates, but not too large, but not too small. So there is a smoothing procedure which works well in that case. Okay, I won't go into detail. I just wanted to mention because that make you aware that such formula exists and are very useful in many, many problems of just classical quantum mechanics. Classical, I mean non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay. So can you, yes. Thank you. So now, in this last 30 minutes, I want to discuss more, go to now real quantum field theory. So what should I? So where is this is medium? So the rear should be. Yes. Okay. So now, let me. Start quantum field theory. So now we are looking at the second part of the course, which are doing real quantum field theory. And as an example, I will take the scalar field because it's a very useful example, but both the simplest case. So you know that the scalar field, so now I am working in Minkowski space. So I have the metric is minus dt squared plus dx squared. Okay, that's my choice of metric. And I will denote by x the Cadre vector in space-time. And the action is S for a scalar field is just integral over d4 x of, and then it's minus 1/2 of d mu phi d mu phi minus m squared over 2 phi squared. This is a classical action in Minkowski space. And if you are working in Euclidean space, so I take t equal minus I. Let us call, this was called tau, but let me call this x naught. This would be just the first Euclidean position. Then the metric is d s squared equal d tau squared plus d x squared. And the Euclidean action then is integral over d 4 x. Now x, the Euclidean term, of plus 1/2 of d mu phi plus n squared over 2 phi squared. Okay. And we are interested in computing transition amplitude and expectation value of operators. Check whether the path integral formalism works. So in order to do path integrals, this means basically that what you have to compute, instead of computing integral over trajectory, you have to integrate over field configuration, phi of x, for all possible field configuration with an exponential of I over h bar s phi, with, for instance, some boundary condition that if you are considering that you, this is time, this is x, you see. I will draw that here. I would draw like rather x like that, you see. This is x, one of the coordinates of space. This is time, this is space. Okay, you may be interested in the fact that the and this is phi, you start from some initial condition. You see, phi 1 at time 1, you end up by some final condition, phi 2 at time t2, and you have to sum over, in some sense, all possible field configuration between the initial condition, phi 1 and phi 2. So basically, you have as boundary conditions the fact that phi at time t1 equals phi 1 and phi at time t2 equals phi 2, where this means field configurations in space only. And in that way, you compute the transition amplitude between field configuration states, if you want, phi 1 to phi 2. Okay? So the question is that, and of course, you do the same thing using the Euclidean action if you want to compute element of the evolution operator of the field at Euclidean time. So for instance, this will give simply something which, let us say, which will be the transition amplitude from a state phi 1 to a state phi 2 with the evolution operator u of t. Okay? And the same thing if you want to compute matrix element of the Euclidean evolution operator. Okay? So now the point is that this, so from this, we are going to pass integral for what is usually denoted functional integrals. Because now we are integrating over field configuration. You see? But so mathematically, just at the formal level, it's the same thing. It's instead that instead of integrating over q of t, we are integrating over configuration phi, phi of t and x. See. So at fixed time, we still are integrating over a lot of field configuration depending on time, on space. Okay? So now the question is, of course, how do we compute that? Because it's a very, very, in fact, it's not a very well, not very well defined object. Okay? So one way to define it is to discretize space and time. And I think that you have met already this idea in the quantum theory course, where I think Adrian Kent showed you that it is possible to quantize the Dirac equation, to treat the Dirac equation at least in one dimension of space and one dimension of space of time, using a way to discretize both space and time. And so, in fact, there is a natural generalization of that which works for any kind of field. So remember, so the basic idea is you start from a system where you have continuous time and continuous space. Okay, so this is continuous. Okay. Remember that when you are doing path integral, already what you have to do is you have to discretize time. Okay? So you discretize time. So instead of starting from a phi of t and x, you discrete time by some path time discretization with, let us say, a time step epsilon. Okay? And you can go one step further and discretize both time like that. So let us phi of x. X will be now epsilon times some vector, where I is a point on a lattice labeled by integer in four dimensions. You see? So instead of having a continuum of field configuration for continuous time and continuous space, you discretize both time and space and replace this formal functional integral over continuous field configuration by, so now this is rear, this is front. So, but I know this doesn't work. So you can discretize that by rewriting your functional integral like so for instance, let us be interested into the Euclidean functional integral. So the integral functional integral will be d of phi of exponential minus 1 over h bar s e of phi. Then it will be replaced by simply a sum, an integral over discretized point, an integral over products over the sites I on the lattice Z4, d phi I denotes the value of the feed on some site I, and then you have an action which is a discretized action, exponential of minus 1 over h bar. And if you think a little bit how you discretize the action, the integral over 4x d4x becomes the sum over the I belonging to the lattice of epsilon to the power 4. This is the volume of over 4. A derivative d mu of phi at some point x becomes, will become simply a finite difference. So it will become the value of phi at site I plus some elementary vector e mu e in the direction mu minus phi of I divided by epsilon. This is a derivative. And this is a finite difference. Well, of course, e mu is just a unit vector in the direction mu. Okay. And therefore, you get something which you can rewrite simply as a sum over the links ij of the lattice. Okay. Because this will give you a term for each slice, and you get an epsilon to the power 4 minus 2 times phi I minus phi g squared, the factor of 1/2, plus for the mass term, you get an epsilon 4 over 2 m squared sum over the I. The size of the lattice, phi I squared. Okay, so this is a natural discretization of the Euclidean functional integral for the free field. Well, instead of being on a continuous space and time, you are on this discretized lattice of space and time. And you recognize that this is nothing but the partition function for a lattice of coupled harmonic oscillator, a coupled classical harmonic oscillator. This represents the energy terms for a single oscillator, and this represents the coupling between the neighboring point of the oscillator. So you have this lattice. These are two neighboring points, I and G, on the lattice. And you have first an oscillator here at each point, and you have a coupling between each point. Okay. So you see that the functional integral of the free field, when you study it in the Euclidean functional integral, is nothing but equivalent to solving a problem of equilibrium statistical mechanics. You have here 1 over h bar, which reminds you that h bar is the analogous of the temperature of your system, temperature of the classical, this classical system, this lattice of oscillator in 4 dimensions. Okay. And so basically, h bar represents the measure, the amplitude of the thermal fluctuation. And for instance, this system is in fact a system I think that you will be studying, or we started to study, in the course of condensed matter, because it describes, for instance, phonons in classical crystals. Okay. So, and of course, what we should do now, if we want to really solve the quantum mechanical problem of quantizing the scalar field in continuous space and time, is to take the continuum limit. Epsilon goes where 0. So this system is easier to solve because it has a discrete number of degrees of freedom. But in order to recover a relativistic system, we expect that we have to take the continuum limit. And in particular, something very important is that on this square lattice, the O4 or O31, let us say O13 Lorentz invariance or rotation invariance is explicitly broken. It's explicitly broken because you have discretized space-time, so you have not invariance by rotation. You have simply the invariance implied by the symmetry of the hypercubic lattice, which is a discrete group. And you have to recover that when you take the continuum limit, we have to check whether we recover Lorentz and Poincaré invariance in the real-time version or the Euclidean invariance, translation and rotation in the Euclidean time formalism. Okay. So you see there are a lot of steps that we will be doing. So what should I do? Now, either I can show you a picture or I can show you a calculation. Perhaps I will show you pictures because that's more funny for the end of the lecture. So now I will discuss, just show you a typical type of, you can ask in such a functional integral, sum of a field configuration, what are the classical trajectory and what are the semi-classical contribution? Of course, you know the action. So you know that the classical contribution are just the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation in the real-time formalism and the Euclidean version. Okay. So now the question is, so that's something you know. The question is, what is the typical size and the typical feature of the contribution which are nearby the classical field configuration, but which contributes to the functional integral? And you can study that problem just by computer. You can take the system in the Euclidean regime, transform it into this system of lattice of coupled oscillator on a discrete lattice with a very, very small time and space discretization, and make numerical simulation or do some probability theory and compute what are the typical configuration which contribute to this configuration. I want to show you a few of those. So may I have the screen again? Nothing is happening. I need the screen. I know it's this one. No, it's on HDMI. Okay. So it should work. It's just some. Come on again. Oh. So let me show you some typical free field configuration, which are the configuration which contributes in the functional integral. And so I've taken something very simple. This is in two dimensions, simply. I am in the Euclidean regime because that's simpler. And so one of the dimension, one of the direction is space. One of the direction is Euclidean time, so there is no difference. And I have taken a space-time which is periodic. So it's a square with periodic boundary condition because it's simpler. So remember, periodicity in space means that your space is periodic. Periodicity in time means that you're considering that the system is at finite temperature. But so that's this is a model of a quantum field, free field, at in a finite on a finite circle and at finite temperature. Okay. And so now this is a number of steps. You know, so I have discretized space-time. So here I have a 74 by 74 lattice. You see? And this is a typical configuration. And you see it's a quite wild configuration. This is a typical configuration. This is a case where the classical configuration is just phi equals 0. So the classical configuration is phi equals 0. Phi, so I have time and x. And phi classical is equal to 0. And I'm looking at the typical phi of quantum configuration in the functional integral which contributes. So you see that it's something which is quite wild, but there are quantum fluctuations. What is interesting is to look at what's happening when you take the limit when the size of space and time stays the same, but I take the limit where the time and space step gets smaller and smaller. Therefore, I'm looking at really the continuum limit when time and space become continuum. Everything else is fixed. So if you do that, now I divide by 2 the time and space interval. And you see that the fluctuations become more wild. Okay. Now, this is 256 by 256. So I divided by 4. You see that the fluctuations become more wild. And this is one more step. So you see that the typical configuration of the Gaussian free field, this means Gaussian free field in French. I hope you're able to translate that in two dimensions. You see that they are, in fact, very, very wild configuration. And in fact, they are much wilder than the random walk, the Brownian motion that you have in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Yes?
So this is the, what is the second derivative of the action? This is what represents total
fluctuations. Yes, so the total, if you sum the contribution of all such typical configuration, which are called Gaussian free field, then you will get the contribution of this determinant to the power minus 1/2.
So this is basically a random walk using Gaussian probability distribution.
Yes, but a Gaussian walk in two dimensions. You have 2 times instead of I1. So it's really what mathematicians call the Gaussian free field or Gaussian sheet. Mathematicians have different names for that, but that's basically the generalization to 2 dimensions of the random walk in 1 dimension. And you see that it's quite difficult because not only the derivative in each time and space direction is different, but you see that you cannot really define what is the average value of the field at one point. See? So in fact, what's happening is that in one dimension, where you have Q of t, you have a random walk. And random walks are functions of time. They are functions which have no derivative, but they are continuous functions. Here, phi typical is not a function, in fact. It's not a random function. It's what mathematicians call a random distribution? No. Distribution are objects which are wilder than function, but you can still integrate them. So in fact, you must keep in fact that in fact we are speaking about functional integral, but when you are quantizing quantum fields, you are really doing some kind of distributional integration instead of functional integration. So this was in two dimensions. You can play the same game in three dimensions. So this is typical configuration of a Gaussian free field in three dimensions. And of course, since difficulty to represent, this is a two-dimensional section. So imagine that you have a cube with periodic boundary condition, and you have your free field fluctuating in this cube. And you just cut your cube. You get a section which is a squared. And you look at the configuration of the field in this section. So it's just a section, a two-dimensional section of a free field in a cube in three dimensions. And same kind of dimension. So now you see the fluctuation. In fact, the fluctuation, well, of course, it's a question of scale, but the fluctuation seems a bit less important. But the point is that what's happening when you take the continuum limit by taking the mesh of the lattice going to zero, everything else being fixed, you see that the same phenomenon occurs. But in fact, oh, sorry, that's something else. If you quantify, you see that it's even wilder. This is more peaked and more, even a fakir would prefer to sit on a two-dimensional Gaussian free field than on a three-dimensional free field because it's more and more irregular. Okay. And what we want now to do, what we'll have to do, if we want first to compute things in with the Gaussian free field, and we want to quantify, in fact, to see what are the physical observables in the quantum theory which contains the information about the fact that the typical configuration in the functional integral are very, very, very wild and much wilder than the typical histories of a particle in non-relativity quantum mechanics. What does it mean for quantum fields? What are the consequences for the physics of quantum fields of the fact that those field configurations are very, very, very wild when you go to short time and short space distances? And I think that's what I will stop there, I think. And we shall see, in fact, next time, simply, well, since I have perhaps 5 minutes, I will just announce the results of next time, which is that. Meet. Let's try this one. What we shall do next time. We shall look at the correlation functions of the field. We shall look at what is happening, what is the expectation value of the field at two different points in the Euclidean time. Okay, and we know from what we have said and calculated last lecture yesterday that when you go from Euclidean time to real time, you expect that this will become the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of two phi operators at different points of space-time. So this will be the time order product. And this will be the vacuum expectation value, which is something which is called the propagator, in fact, the Feynman propagator that we have been studying in the quantum field theory course 1. And what I will show next time is that by an easy calculation, this correlator behaves when x minus y goes to 0 as x minus y to the power minus, and if you are in Euclidean spacetime with d dimension, d minus 2 over 2, where d is a dimension of spacetime. And in part, this is a result which is valid when the dimension is larger than 2, so in 3 or 4 dimensional spacetime. And in fact, there is a logarithm of x minus y when d equal 2. So the next time we shall compute this object by functional integration method, we shall check that we recover the Feynman propagator in real time that you have been studying in the quantum field theory 1 course. And I will see that I will show you that, in fact, those irregularities in the field configuration are contained in the fact that this propagator, this correlation function, diverge, is singular, at short distances, because this is a negative power if the dimension is larger than 2, and this is a logarithmic singularity. And we shall see what it means for the quantum field theory. Okay? Thank you. Yes? Pardon?
I think the first equation Q dot P,
yes,
is equal to something. The dimension analysis.
The dimension analysis. You will see that's not completely true. Okay, let me try to. This was the front, so let me draw it back.
No.
Oh, no, this is weird. Yeah. Yeah, you might think that the dimensional analysis is wrong, but that's not correct because you see. Well, of course, first there is a mass. There is somewhere. There is a mass. So first, yeah, there is a square root of mass first. it was a sketchy. Because in fact, no, the point is simply that in the path integral formulation, you have a weight which is minus integral over dt m over h bar, something like that. You see? So this is basically a delta t. This is a delta t m over h bar q dot square. So this means that q dot is a random variable. Is local in time. Local in time, such that q dot squared on the average is proportional to h bar divided by m divided by delta t. But basically, 1 over delta t, which is infinite in this case, is simply a way to rewrite delta of 0. So in that case, you see that this equation becomes that with the fact that eta is a white noise, but it has a dimension of the inverse of a time. So eta has a dimension of a time to the power minus 1/2. Okay. And then dimensional analysis works.
Okay.
Yes? Yes?
All the time
is in the system finite. Yes.
We don't have any evolution in real time, we only see a static configuration.
Yeah, in this case of picture, yes,
okay.
It's static in real time.
Okay, what if we want to expose that